Blessings, beautiful listener. Stuart Watkins here, your host. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm currently in Los Angeles with the family. It's been a beautiful few weeks, and we're really excited to get back to Perth for an incredible summer. Coming up in just a few weeks is Flow Festival. I know, already here, nearly. January 10th weekend up in Serpentine. We have just released day tickets. So if you can't make it for the whole weekend or you're not a camping type, you can still join us. It's going to be awesome. The whole Saturday is going to be a jam-packed day. You are most welcome to stay as late as you want or camp for the one night. Most likely, you're going to want to join us for the whole weekend, but if that's not possible or you don't want to, get a day ticket. It's going to be so sweet, heart-opening, inspiring, energizing, grounding, all the good stuff wrapped up in a beautiful weekend up in Serpentine, Western Australia. So come and join us. I'll leave a link below. Today's podcast is with my Flow Festival co-creator, Amanda Noga. Before we get into it, I just want to mention another thing we're doing on December 14th. I'll be collaborating with Sai Malumbi at Spunda Yoga School in South Fremantle. So come and join us. I love collaborating with Sai Malumbi. He is a powerhouse. It's going to be a three-hour deep dive into the heart, into vulnerability, into our true sense of empowerment. Check out that link below as well. And I hope to see you there from 2 until 5 at Spunda Yoga School. Back to Amanda Noga. She is one of my closest friends. Love her to bits. She's an inspiration, a true master of Ayurveda. She's really been diving deep into the art, into the wisdom, the knowledge of Ayurveda, and combining that with yoga, which it kind of is meant to do. It's kind of the sister science of yoga. If you're not aware of what Ayurveda is, it's so comprehensive and so practical in really optimizing how we are in these bodies on this earth, in this particular incarnation. And Amanda is really skillful at optimizing because we're all unique and different. And she's becoming really masterful at tuning into the individual and helping one optimize their life. Because what might be optimum for me might not be for you, etc., etc. So she's now doing one-on-ones, which you can book in. She's going to be in Perth for the whole summer, and you can check out the information below on that as well. She's pretty interactive online. She's got some really cool courses and interactive things you can dive into, which I'll leave links below as well. What else is happening? She's the founder of Karma Collab, a non-profit jewelry range that is exquisite. I'll leave links to that as well. I love all the work that Amanda does. It all comes from the heart and the soul, and it's just really aligned with beauty and integrity and wisdom. This chat with Amanda, I love. It's really you tuning into us, catching up. We had not caught up in quite a while, and we had a nice amount of time to chat and catch up and talk about flow and what's happening in our lives. So I hope you find it inspirational. I definitely did. I always do find it inspiring catching up with Amanda. But be sure to join us at Flow Festival. It's going to be awesome. Joe, my wife, will be teaching. So many incredible teachers will be teaching and lecturing and dancing. There's going to be epic DJs and that exquisite water hole. Can you hear Lani? She's calling out daddy. So I better go soon, but I can't rave enough about Flow Festival. We're so excited that it's just a few weeks away. Hope to see you soon. Happy holidays. Enjoy the summer. And I hope to see you around. Much love. Give it up for Amanda Noga. Here we are, Amanda Noga. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy to be back in Australia.
Yeah.
Which is something that I wouldn't have necessarily thought I would be saying.
How come?
Last one we did was in Bali, I think. In Bali. In the past, I've always felt a little bit, I guess, conflicted about coming back. And it's always, not always, but it sometimes felt a bit jarring after being, you know, roaming around in India and Bali. And
you are a nomad.
I am, but I'm starting to feel the pull in the other direction. I think I've gone as far as I could go on the nomadic end of the spectrum.
You got as minimalistic as possible. How minimal did you get your suitcase? I mean, I was pretty impressed how compact you got it.
It's pretty good. I'm down to an even smaller suitcase now.
Wow.
But I have to admit, I've got about like the equivalent of this bookshelf behind us at my parents' house.
Right.
In books.
Yeah.
In boxes. So that's, you know, cheating a little bit. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what comes with me for most of the year, it's pretty low and it feels good. It feels
nice, so liberating. It's so liberating.
Yeah. It is scary though when you think if that bag gets lost on this flight, I'm fucked. That's all I've got. That's all my stuff. But no, my bag is mostly ridiculous. Like at least half of it is crystals and oils.
Get a bit closer to that mic. You got a soft voice. I want to hear it nice.
Crystals
and clear.
And oils and, you know, tarot cards and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's really an impractical suitcase.
But speaking of tarot cards, I just got informed the other day that Doreen Virtue, the
yes, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, she thinks it's all bullshit.
Yes,
yeah, she born is again
born
Christian.
Again.
Yeah, I mean that's an empire.
I know. I mean, she's got apps, like not even just cards, but like apps of the cards. Yeah. I know it is. It is interesting. I listened to an interview with her the other day. She's pretty hardcore on the Christian train. But I don't know. I guess it's good to reevaluate this stuff and to not be dogmatic about anything, including tarot cards.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool in a way. Like she built such an empire out of what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a demonstration of non-attachment in a way.
Yeah. I'm sure some people are pretty upset.
Yeah.
Investing all their
We've got a
belief.
Few back here.
Right yeah, there. I mean, she's famous. She's probably like the biggest kind of person in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it must have taken a lot for her to like step away and go in the other direction.
Yeah.
But yeah, in a way, I think it is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about flow.
It's Mandy around the corner.
We've just had, a couple hours talking about flow. But
yep,
I don't
flow
think
festival.
We're Flow Festival coming up January 10, 2020. It's a great number, isn't it?
I know. That's one of the reasons why I wanted it.
10, 2020.
And it's the first full moon of the year. Very special day. Usually we do it on the solstice in December. But we were feeling the pull to kind of change the date and bring it into the year of 2020. And I think the January time is going to add quite a different feeling to the whole thing.
Less flies.
Less flies, for starters. But December can be a pretty overwhelming time.
Pre-Christmas.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of
holidays,
commitments.
Yeah.
Whereas January is sort of just like, oh, okay, we're really on holidays now. Like summer has set in. We can spend a bit more time and I think that will be the vibe of this flow, a lot more relaxed and just family focused, friend focused, community focused.
Unplugging focused. That feels so important, like more important than it has previously. This
we
need to unplug and get our feet on the earth and jump in that water and be in community. It feels more important to me than ever right now.
Yeah, that water is pristine. Mm-hmm. I was there on the weekend and it's like crystalline. It just instantly It's like a, this is going to sound cheesy, but it's like an aura cleanse as soon as you jump in. It's like every layer of your being is purified. Yeah. And yeah, being in the middle of the forest there on that piece of land, we're literally surrounded on three sides of the property by state forest. So you're really like in a Wi-Fi free zone, which is pretty hard to find.
Yeah, I remember in the lead up to last flow, a couple of those nights in preparation for flow, just that deeper connection we had. Like there were some big aha moments of like, wow, this place is incredible.
Totally.
And just really feeling the land and the forest. And we're so lucky to have that available. And over the years, the place is it was pretty messy when we first got there.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it had been, I guess, kind of abandoned land for 40 years. Yeah. Abandoned and abused. And for the prior 40 years, people in the local area had been using it kind of as their local hangout, but no one really taking responsibility for taking all the garbage and broken beer bottles and stuff like that, which obviously we don't want anywhere near us. But that's all disappeared now.
Yeah,
and
it just feels pristine,
beautiful.
Huh?
It's incredible. And, you know, the land is called Serpentine. Yeah. Like that in itself is really powerful. Yeah. It's serpentine land. And I won't pretend to know anything about Aboriginal culture, but it's, you know, it is an important part of our state and a really precious thing that we can be there and be there in such a sacred way as well with intention and, yeah, like you said, coming back to community and unplugging.
Yeah. What are you most excited about for this coming flow? What comes straight to mind? What you're vibing off?
I'm really excited to see everybody again. Mm-hmm. For me, it feels a bit like a reunion because I am kind of in and out of WA and it's so nice to see everybody gather in this way. Mm-hmm. It's just, and that's, yeah, I mean, you know, we've had all these incredible artists and we have got incredible artists coming this year and that's exciting. But at the end of the day, just being with everybody like that and all of people tell me constantly about their, you know, crazy, beautiful experiences that they've had at past flow festivals and it's really cool. Yeah. People have fallen in love. People have, you know, conceived babies and had transformational experiences and, you know, it's pretty cool.
Mm.
And that's, I think, one of the main reasons we wanted to do it in the first place. That was like one of our original intentions is just to have kind of a neutral space for all of the different corners of our yoga and beyond community to come together. And it's happening.
It totally is. I was talking about it with Julian, Sai and Simon earlier, that vision that we've had with Flow from the Heart and with Flow, that kind of microcosm to the macrocosm, kind of tipping point potential of what can happen, what does happen when we come together with the group mind and the group heart with intention and joy and connectivity. And it's powerful. And in this current time where, again, the paradox that often comes up in these podcasts and what a lot of people are talking about is like we're so connected with our phones and with social media. We're so connected, yet people are unbearably disconnected. Mm-hmm. And there's a real phenomenon of that agony, really. It's driving a lot of people mad.
Mm-hmm.
So it really feels not just beautiful and like necessary for us, wherever we are in the world, to seek out community and nature and put the phone down for a few days.
3 days.
And really connect. And that's also what I'm most excited about is to, I mean, what I've got a few like peak memories of each flow and they all are to do with that water. And like being in that water with everyone just, it feels like utopia.
Yeah.
All the smiles and the flowing freedom and the music. I can recall several just like peak moments where it's like, oh, wow.
I know.
This is,
I was telling my parents about the first, the memory that we both share about the first flow, the first ever, which is a very humble, sweet gathering. And your parents and my parents all rocked up at the same time at like probably 2 o'clock on the Saturday. And it was just the perfect moment of all the stuff that had gone crazy and wrong and whatever, and, you know, the usual chaos of organizing an event. But they rocked up and it was just like there was a DJ playing on the lake and everyone was having lots of fun. And it was just like that scene is burned in my mind. And we're like, yes, like they saw the good bit. Yeah. But yeah, it's the water there is magical. Mm-hmm. There's
and
no,
that clay, how many shades of color are there in that clay? Like,
well, that's pretty
black
cool.
And there's
like
red and white.
Yeah, when the water level drops down, you know, by the end of summer, you can see all of the different layers. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, the top is kind of just the white clay. So some people might not know, but the land was originally way, way back in like the early 1900s was a clay mine. So that's what the big holes are in the ground. They were mining for clay. And that finished, I think, in the 1940s. But yeah, when the water level drops, you can see all those different layers and they kind of bleed into each other. And it's just, it's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do love, in preparation, just getting naked and just smothering my body in clay. Getting my feet on the earth,
so
playing a
goody.
Bit of didge, sunshine, and then yeah. jumping in that water. Like, that is medicine. Like, that feels
totally.
Like ultimate self-care.
Well, I think that's like one of the things that's holding Flow Festival together is like, in those weeks leading up, it's so crazy, but we get to spend so much time on that land
yeah.
that is so grounding, and it kind of simplifies, you know, sometimes when we're in the city, we can get a bit overwhelmed and, you know, this is beyond flow. I'm sure lots of people can relate to this. You get kind of consumed with all of the things that need to be done and lists and being pulled in multiple directions and 100 different messages to reply to and whatever. But then you step onto that land and all of a sudden it just dissolves and you realize everything's going to be okay, mm-hmm. you know? And it's just, we can all do with remembering that. It's really mm-hmm. medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else are you vibing off? What's been a highlight of this year for you? How many countries have you been in?
Oh, God. Well, I don't know in the year, but I know we've just been on tour in Europe and we did 15 cities in 2 months. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm not keeping track, but that was it was actually really fun 2 months. Pretty full on in some ways, like, you know, literally changing locations every 3 or 4 days. But, you know, being in my little bubble in Bali, I had gotten to the point where I was like, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to get back in the world and, you know, be with people again, because Bali, of course, it's busy in its own way, but it's very insular. But so, yeah, being in Europe was wonderful. Just, you know, interfacing with lots and lots of students from all different parts of Europe and sharing what I love. Sharing the yoga, sharing the Ayurveda, and just making those connections. And I guess it's been maybe 4 or 5 years of doing that kind of circuit. And again, it's all about relationships and those connections, coming back to see familiar faces and meeting new people. It's really beautiful. Mm. It makes the world feel quite small. And even though traveling can be crazy and draining, when you're returning to familiar spaces and familiar people, it's so worth it. It's beautiful.
But now you're feeling the call to nest.
I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why. So this is the first year in 10 years that I haven't been to India. And it's kind of a grief, if I'm honest. Like,
yeah, you do have a strong pull there. So do I, but you...
Yeah, I usually spend at least, you know, 2, 3, 4 months there, yeah, and that's been kind of my flow for a long time. And this year it's kind of been removed from the schedule, and I'm coming to terms with the fact that it's never going to be the same.
Why?
So I'm just kind of like skirting around, aren't I? So
we were just, Mandy's pregnant. Ooh. And we were just umming and ahhing on our drive back here to set up for the podcast. Like people been asking Mandy about like, how are you going to announce it? And like, so this is, I guess, the first announcement, unless you post or something about it in the weeks leading up.
Yeah.
Which you may.
I may.
It's a mystery, but.
But yes. Yeah,
so congratulations.
Thank you. It's very exciting. And yeah, I mean, it's miraculous and scary and everything. Full
it's
spectrum.
Miraculous. I mean, what a journey. Building a baby in your belly. What a trip.
I know. I recently did a kind of training about pre and postnatal and, you know, active birthing and kind of doula stuff. And they showed a video in that about, you know, the process of conception, like an animated sort of YouTube video thing. And it is insane when you think about all of the miracles that come together for a sperm meeting an egg and everything happening, like all the mini miracles and the processes that happen. It's just beyond. It's beyond words for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, to feel that happening inside you is... it's beyond. I have no words for it right now. But yeah, that has meant that my whole travel agenda for the second half of this year kind of changed, and that meant removing India, which, yeah, it's a little bit sad because, I mean, I know I'll be back in India eventually, but it won't be in the same way at all. I mean, I remember you took Soleil when she was really little.
Yeah, that was hectic.
Yeah.
It was so hectic. We had...
She was like less than one.
Oh, yeah. She was 6 months. And we had 30-something people on our retreat. We all got brutally ill. It was a heat wave that we were in.
In Rishikesh.
It was
in the mountains.
Brutal heat wave. And... I felt so bad. Like, it's a place I go to whenever I can. And I love this Ayurvedic cafe next door to the ashram.
Yeah. I know that place.
But so during this heat wave, their refrigerator broke down. And I just love this mango lassi. I'd get this mango lassi every day. And enthusiastically, I told everyone, get this mango lassi. But that was the culprit of getting everyone sick. And like the whole, almost everyone but Sue. Good on you, Sue. You knew not
to. She held strong.
Held strong. Didn't have the mango lassi. But... yeah, I mean, Soleil was brutally ill. Joe, me, that was challenging.
Yes.
That was a huge lesson in the juggle of holding space for your students and your baby and your partner. And it was a huge lesson while being brutally ill.
Oh, God.
And then Soleil had it on the last day. Yeah, we were like wrapping up the retreat and she had this really bad fall onto like marble type floor and got knocked unconscious and like peak
so
hour
scary.
India traffic. We're on the back, either the memory's a bit faint, like back of a rickshaw or a scooter type thing, trying to find somewhere to scan her. And make sure, because she came too and everything seemed fine, but we're like, fuck, like, if she's got internal bleeding in north of India, like, this could be really fucking bad. And just racing around trying to find somewhere to scan and give some sense of peace and...
Oh, it gives me shivers.
Yeah, it was hectic. It was really hectic. Joe doesn't want to go back.
Yeah, fair enough.
I do. I love it, but we would do it differently.
Yeah, that's
we
the
were
thing.
In a, like, the our
you were
hosts.
Trying to recreate your ashram.
Yeah, life. Well, the ashram was fine. Our hosts of the ashram thought, okay, they're coming as a family. We'll put them up in an apartment. So they put us up in this apartment near the ashram, mm-hmm. which was filthy. Aww. Normal, you know,
normal North standard. Indian standard. Yeah.
But filthy.
Yeah, especially when you've got like the heightened senses of having a 6-month-old baby.
Yeah, so we think that was part of what got us particularly ill.
Oh, I mean, traveling, of course, to India, but anywhere, it really takes a toll on your immune system and your nervous system, which is, I guess, another reason why I've been traveling for the last few years non-stop, and it wasn't until I got to Bali at the beginning of this year that I realized the toll that I had been taking on my nervous system.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly doing everything that I can to take care of that and to take care of my immune system. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, there's only so much you can do. It's not good for you. It's so unnatural to go that far that fast.
Yeah.
Not to mention
apparently the outrageous amount of radiation. Not like I kind of conceived of it as like, okay, yeah, when you're going through the x-ray machines and all that. But even on the plane that whole time.
Yeah. You're like in blasted. A chamber of EMF, and going through the metal detector is equivalent to 5 hours of flying.
Really?
The same amount of radiation happens in that moment.
Wow.
So this is a hack that I've recently been doing, and with no qualms from security, I've just been saying, oh, I'm pregnant. Can I not go through the metal detector? Mm-hmm. And they always say, yep, that's fine. Yeah. They give you an extra pat down, of course, whatever. But I'm going to do that forever, whether I'm pregnant or not.
Mm-hmm.
Anything to do to skip that part is like, yeah.
Apparently, silver, like you can get silver material, is really good for like a shield.
Yeah.
Don't know how effective, but...
I do have like a travel outfit, which includes, you know, silver, like supposedly EMF blocking shirt and like underwear sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got my crystals and I've got, you know, my little affirmations. I don't know if any of it does anything, but...
It's something.
I mean, it makes you feel a little bit better. Mm-hmm. At least you've done what you can. I know some people have like a special coil something that they put underneath their seat that's supposed to do something. But yeah, I mean, it's rough, like no matter what.
It's rough. But we love it.
We love it.
To travel, and we're so lucky we can...
I mean, the other part that plays on my mind is the sustainability part.
True.
It's really bad for the environment.
Yeah.
And you know, some people I know are taking sailboats everywhere, but for most people that's totally not an option. I don't know what we're going to do, really, as a humanity.
We got to... Because we know the technologies are there for healthier ways of traveling.
Do you mean like electronic planes?
Yeah, well, and these UFOs that have been spotted.
Oh, yeah.
UFO technology that's been...
Did you listen to the recent Joe Rogan?
And Bob Lazar? Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, so good. So it's becoming mainstream information. It's not.
Well, I think so, but like no one seems to be talking about it. Like I feel like we've been talking about this for like 15 years. Yeah. Like, oh, it's so getting so mainstream. But where?
It's so interesting how it is. And we've got really credible professionals
totally
coming out with such undeniable evidence. Yeah.
Well, to be fair,
weird.
Like I think a lot of the people that probably reported UFO sightings in the past were just made out to seem crazy and illegitimate. And they probably felt really nervous about saying that. You know, to me, I'm like, they are just as credible as the CIA guy or the military guy.
Yeah.
I don't need convincing. There's definitely UFOs and aliens. I'm on board.
I don't need convincing either. I haven't seen any.
I would love to see one.
Joe has.
Daya Dover said that she saw a UFO at Flow Festival once.
Wouldn't be surprised.
That's a reason to come to Flow.
Yeah. I've seen some epic star shows there, like on a clear night, the star.
Oh my God.
Galactic.
Yeah.
Shooting stars galore. And it's so clear.
Out in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, the technology is there, but it's a huge change of the game. I mean,
But so many things are riding on the oil and gas industry staying.
It is, but like, I think we're getting there. You know, like, it's crazy when we drop into LA, like, it's so polluted. But there are, you know, Teslas everywhere and these new technologies emerging. It's becoming
same in
mainstream.
Northern Europe.
Yeah.
Like, most of the cars you see, to be fair, in the major cities, you don't see so many cars. They have such awesome public transport. And then a lot of the cars are electric cars. It's really, but I think in Europe it's quite great because they have a big, big subsidy on electric cars.
Right.
Especially in like Norway, Denmark, Germany, those countries. It's super cheap. Well, maybe it's not super cheap, but it's definitely not what we'd pay for a Tesla here.
Yeah, we got a long way to go here. You don't see many at all here. And or just other brands of electric cars that are pretty abundant.
Well, I have a conspiracy theory about Australia. And I think to a point, America as well. I think the oil and because Australia, well, especially WA, is so heavily reliant on oil and gas for our industry, I think that there's a lot of interest in keeping the public transport system pretty crap and keeping a lot of people reliant on cars. I've got no proof to back this up.
I hear you.
But
I hear it.
I mean, yeah. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the plane thing. Wouldn't it be cool? I mean, what these guys are showing with the technology. I mean, how quick we could travel and like, no.
Or maybe just get like holographed over.
Holographed.
Like if you needed to do a meeting or something, or like Joey, she could like holograph herself into the Yoga Glue studio.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that shit's far off. No. I really don't. Like,
you'd be the first person on it if it came in.
I have hesitation though.
People
like when
you're crazy, but you
when you hear of the AI technologies and all of that that are emerging quicker than I think we think. Yes and no, I'd be the first to hop on it. Like, I'm not going to put a chip in my brain or that.
Have you seen the Neuralink?
Well, the Neuralink thing. Yeah. Like, I've got major hesitation
Same.
Over that. Like,
it's bad news.
So it seems pretty not too far out to think once we get that Neuralink, we'll be able to operate similar to how we operate the phone. Like,
yeah.
So like, I mean, the concept of like Skype and all that not too long ago seemed outrageous.
Yeah.
To be able to be walking along and be on Skype, like that was outrageous, incredible what we can do just on the phone.
Yeah.
And the pace.
I kind of want like the phone as far away from me as possible.
So do I. Like there's a movement.
Let alone in my brain.
Yeah. I was just speaking with Alex King, an incredible musician, on an episode, and he was talking about the concept of revillaging, of like, which is one of the concepts of flow, of like embracing technology, but yeah, like you just said, put the phone away, let's revillage, which is what we're doing with flow.
That's a cool word.
Keep our humanity, keep our human element, because just like the smartphone, like, I don't know if you were, but I was one of those people that had hesitation over even just having a smartphone.
Yeah.
It's like, not for me. But then it becomes normalized. You know?
And you sort of need it to function in the world.
Yeah, and you're kind of...
Well, that's what I wonder if like the Neuralink will become... If you don't know what we're talking about, you're going to have to link in the show notes what Neuralink is all about.
Yeah.
But, you know, eventually maybe... it will become impossible to participate in society unless you have this chip. Like imagine if you didn't have a phone right now. It would be pretty hard if you wanted to get a job or, you know, pretty much do anything. I mean, I'm sure you would find other ways, but it would be really hard. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the way it will go if we all get these chips and then it becomes the norm and then there's no way out.
And if everyone's operating at this like new level of superimposed intelligence, like the 'cause one of the concepts of it is that our our speed of cognition right now is at a different speed of the phone. And that Neuralink will merge the speed so there'll be no separation between like...
The processing.
So right now it's pretty fucking good of being able to talk to Siri or punch in almost anything and have endless information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like apparently, and this is already getting developed. It's already
like in trials, isn't it? There's no gap between thinking, oh... I want to Google this and the information being already in your...
Yeah.
In your
it's almost like building another frontal
second
lobe.
Brain.
Yeah. And so if everyone's operating at that type of intelligence, it would be very similar to being the only one without Skype
so
or without
behind.
The phone or so far behind. So it gets normalized.
Yeah. But of course, this is only one level of intelligence.
Yes, of course.
And there's no way for them to also increase our emotional intelligence and
totally.
Our energetic and our intuition and all of those other types of intelligence will diminish if all of our energy is being put into just cognitive kind of mental intelligence.
Which is evident already.
Right.
People being on their phones so much is fucking people up. It screws with the dopamine levels, serotonin, and all of that. It's already blatantly obvious that being on the phone too much fucks you up.
Yeah.
You won't sleep as well. You won't feel
as
good.
Destroys the body-based intelligence.
Yeah. So it's already totally evident. So yeah, it's pretty much turning us into robots. So we need these... revillaging movements and these festivals and retreats and immersions that reinforce sense of community and how good it is to be without that fucking phone in your hand and without being plugged in constantly and eye-to-eye contact and actual conversation. That's one of the main things I love about these podcasts, even though we're plugged in big time. Like the format of like, a whole
long
hour,
form.
If not more, of like eye to eye.
Just no distraction.
No distraction, no filter. Like just, it's really good for me. Like it's therapeutic for me.
And they're my favorite type of podcast to listen to as well. Yeah.
So as we get all fixated on the technology, it does seem, I don't know if it's equal, but I hope it's equal. Like this rewilding movement, this revillaging movement.
Equal.
You don't think?
I wish it was equal.
Yeah.
I mean, when you put it like that, talking about flow again, it feels like we need way more than 3 days to truly
recalibrate,
disconnect, to reconnect. Mm-hmm. Ideally, we would do a week, but I mean...
I totally agree. And every time there are countless people that come up and go, can't we add another 2 days on at least? And yeah, like Mandy said, like we would love to, but until we've got a bigger team that can handle it.
And I think it does take that little bit of time, you know, maybe for some people it's shorter or longer, but it does take a little moment at least to kind of like detox out of the, out of all of the busyness and all of the stuff that's going on. Mm-hmm. There's like kind of a, there's a lag time there. Yeah. But yeah, maybe in the future it would be cool to do kind of a retreat off the back of the festival, mm-hmm. one side or the other.
Yeah.
I think that would be nice.
I've also heard from people like, I don't camp. When are you going to release day tickets? Like I don't.
Well, my first thing to say is we have beautiful glamping tents that are basically not camping at all.
Shout out to Soul Camping. We love you.
Yeah. They do such an amazing job. So they set up these super luxe Lotus Bell tents and kit them out with, you know, cute fairy lights and rugs and a beautiful mattress and proper, you know, sheets and pillows and the whole shebang.
It's barely camping.
It's super comfy.
Yeah.
So that would be my first port of call. So nice. And everything's taken care of. You literally just rock up like a hotel and you're all set, ready to go. You don't need to pack anything up or put anything up. It's a pretty good option.
Second port of call?
Second port of call is...
Toughen up.
Day tickets. My parents have suggested that I get a caravan since I'll be pregnant.
Ah.
Like, no. I was like, my first thought was like, Stu will kill me. He will rip me to shreds if I get
Think of Jo. She was very pregnant at the last flow with Lani.
I know.
But we set up our own glamping tent. We have a super comfy mattress. You can do it really well.
Yeah. No, but I don't need a caravan.
Get a caravan,
no,
sure.
No.
Just means we got to let everyone bring
That's the thing. No. Aside from, I mean, I can relate to the I don't camp thing.
Yeah.
I never camped pre-flow. I mean, maybe a couple of times, but never in a like proper way. It's not like I ever owned a tent or anything before. So I can relate. Second port of call is day tickets. We're going to release them maybe around the time when this podcast comes out.
Mm-hmm.
There will be day tickets available, which means you're welcome to stay actually for one night, or you could just rock up for the day and then bail when you feel. So that would be like from the Saturday midday-ish.
And then you get to 10 a.m.
Yeah, you get to enjoy all of the workshops and stuff that are on the Saturday, as well as, of course, the evening program. And then if you didn't want to stay, you could get back in the car and leave. But what we've found in the past is most people, once they get there, they don't actually want to leave.
Yeah.
And they end up sleeping in their car.
Yeah, I
or
mean,
something like that.
It really is a rich day. And this flow where focusing on quality over quantity, so longer workshops, less to choose from, right? Like quality over quantity. Whereas before, there's been so much to choose from, and there's been a bit of a vibe of people running from this thing to that thing, which was pretty common with these types of festivals. We're very much wanting to bring in a bit more of a retreat type experience.
Yeah.
In which there'll be longer format workshops, a bit more spaciousness in between each offering.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really drop in, and the transition from those beautiful offerings during the day to a really epic evening fire ceremony. Unless it's a really...
unless it's 36 degrees.
Yeah, like the little contained Agnihotra, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
Into a beautiful... For the people that want to dance all night, I mean, the DJs, some of the best DJs in Perth with Ben Taff and Willie Slade and Phil Stroud and Bonnie Upwelling. Like, it's going to be a beautiful Saturday night for the day trippers. The cacao ceremony, Simon Lumbee, Mandy Nelson, Kate.
Nelson.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. I've wanted to make the workshops a bit longer as well, so that you have that real opportunity to drop in with the teacher and what they're offering. In the past, I think we've done 45-minute slots, and that was mainly down to the amount of kind of demand of people wanting to offer.
Yeah.
The number of people that, you know, were reaching out really keen to teach or, you know, share whatever they do at Flow. And we had the tendency to say yes to kind of everybody, which meant scheduling from, I think, literally 45-minute slots from 6 a.m. through to like 10 p.m. every night.
Yeah, that was a challenge of scheduling that because we're friends with so much of the community and, yeah, we're yes people. And, yeah, so much gratitude to everyone that has applied.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, there's just a limited amount of slots. So,
and, you know, space as well. We're in the forest. There's only so much shade that we can logistically create. So yeah, there are natural limitations, which I think is actually going to help to refine the offerings. And yeah, like you said, cut out that whole feeling of having to run from one thing to the next and fear of missing out and all that sort of thing. And that kind of like a Vata-inducing festival vibe that I see all the time. I think the emphasis on slowing down and that being reflected in the schedule is going to be really medicinal for everybody. Yeah.
It feels really nice what we've spoken about of wrapping up each night with sound healing, stargazing, full moon gazing, because we've done that, but we haven't included that into the Flow Festival yet. That feels really spot on to wrap up the night after all the deep workshops and immersions and talks and all of that great stuff, a big day out of being in the sun and then dancing our asses
getting
off.
Getting high off cacao and fun and...
lay back.
And let it all integrate.
In. Yeah, that feels perfect.
Yeah.
Feels really balanced and well-rounded and prepare the circuitry for a really deep sleep and
then
do it all again.
And that's usually what we end up doing when we go there, like with just us and our crew. It's, you know, that's kind of the natural flow of getting like coming up and then coming back down. And that's where some of their like most favorite memories and special things have happened is, you know, in that
moment
integration
of,
time. So yeah, I think this flow is aligning a bit more with our values in a way of like honoring rest and integration and really taking care of yourself in a holistic way rather than like more is more sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back to the baby growing in your belly.
Oh yeah.
How has your journey been with that in terms of your lifestyle and your dietary habits and Ayurvedic principles and all that? Have there been any changes? I mean...
Well, lots of changes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's obvious changes, but any radical changes in terms
of... Well, the first part was quite... a big adjustment for me just in terms of how much food I needed to eat and the regularity. That's one of my big bad tendencies, which you always tell me off for, is not eating regularly. And I know that this just exacerbates the Vata. I know it intellectually and I know it firsthand. But, you know, when you have that constitution, it's your like natural way to skip meals and to forget about eating and not prioritize it. And all of a sudden, I couldn't do that. I really couldn't do that. And I was just feeling so nauseous if I didn't eat like literally every 3 or 4 hours. And usually I wouldn't even eat. Usually I'd start the day with a good coffee, like with fat. And then maybe not have a lunch until like 1. Sometimes it would stretch out to 2. If I was being silly, it would go, you know, until 4 o'clock and I'd be like, fuck, I haven't eaten today. You're like rolling your eyes like, yeah, I know.
Seeing your Vata expand into the cosmos.
But Yeah, right away it was like, I need to eat breakfast and it needs to be like not just a piece of fruit, like something like serious, you know, like, so I've been doing oats. That's kind of a good thing for me. So that's been a big thing, but I feel like that I've got kind of gotten used to that now, eating all the time.
It suits you, a bit of extra kaffir.
Yeah, that is my kind of like optimal dosha.
When you're eating enough.
Yeah, is vata kaffir. That's my like happy place. But I mean, of course, the travel in the last few years hasn't helped the vata end of the spectrum. The vata gets out of balance pretty easily.
If you're like, what the fuck are you talking about, vata kapha? Just have a quick Google of the doshas.
Yes.
Ayurvedic doshas. It's a really great, you could call it a map of our constitution.
Really good framework.
Framework can really help if you get your doshas worked out in balance. It can really, really help you thrive and be in your optimum balance.
It supports every single area of your life.
Yeah, it's super intelligent.
Yeah, it's the world's oldest holistic medicinal system. And it's something that goes hand in hand with yoga. I mean, really, yoga comes under the umbrella of Ayurveda, but that's a bit of a tangent. But in terms of eating, I'm grappling with the idea of introducing animal products into my diet. It feels weird even to say animal products. It's not a product. It's an animal. Animal, what do you say? Like animal protein? Whatever.
Animals.
I've been vegetarian for a while. Maybe since I was 15 or 16. And I've been through phases of being raw vegan and, you know, more kind of strict and rigid about it. And now over the last few years, I've been more in the Ayurvedic way of having, you know, ghee and yoga and, you know, eggs and stuff like that, honey. So I'm definitely not vegan. I haven't been for a long time. But a lot of the research that I've been doing and reading that I've been doing from the world of Ayurveda and other people and other schools of thought, there's a very strong teaching that there are really important foods for fertility and for pregnancy and for making a baby. And they include meat or, you know, organ meats, bone broth, stuff like that.
Bivalves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to talk about pushing it to the next level.
What's
in the valves?
They're very complete. They're, according to our dear brother Heath, mm-hmm. And I've been researching it since. They're really the most complete food we can get.
Interesting.
Loaded with iron, protein,
omega 3s. See, this is the thing. Having a blood test reveals that I have low iron, mm-hmm. which came as no surprise. I've never had a blood test that didn't come up as me being anemic since I was a teenager or even before that. And all of the women in my family, my mum, my sister, my grandma, aunties, everyone has low iron. So I wasn't surprised to find out, oh, I'm pregnant, I've got low iron. Of course, the baby's taking any bit of iron. But yeah, it's something that I really want to prioritize. But it's a bit of a mind hurdle.
Spirulina?
Yeah, spirulina.
That's very high in it. Joe, her kind of default is to have very low iron,
mm-hmm.
and she occasionally high doses with spirulina, and that gets it right up very quick.
I'm having a bad feeling about spirulina just at this moment because I had some in Bali that went bad,
went moldy
off, and I was still having it because I was like, I really need this. And then Mark smelled it one day. He's like, this is not good anymore. Really?
What does it smell like? Because, I mean, it doesn't smell good.
It never smells good, exactly. So it's hard to tell, but it was smelling very seaweedy, very fishy. Like, it was bad.
Tenfold.
It was real bad. Mm. So I have a bit of a bad memory about spirulina, right. But I need to just kind of get over that. And yeah, and I'm really having to reconcile, you know, how much conditioning I have given myself around eating meat.
Yeah, totally understand. And it's a heated conversation. And even you just bringing that up, us talking about it, I know it'll get a lot of people
prickly,
triggered, without a doubt. And understandably, like the meat industry needs to change. It needs to radically change the way we've collectively been perceiving meat. Like you said, like it came out very natural animal products. We've kind
it's
of convenienced,
yes,
so to speak, animals. Yeah. And it's neatly packaged and that whole game needs to change. And the collective perception of what meat is and how it's produced and how it's being treated and that whole thing needs to shift. But as well, over the years, my attachment to my beliefs of what's right and wrong has broadened. I used to be very strong in my stance of no one should eat meat ever, like no questions about it. And it was a very excessive standpoint.
Again, the dogmatic piece comes into play with food.
It does. And there's a big war, like relatively speaking, there's a war going on of these different beliefs and opinions of food and animals and all that. And I totally agree that the game needs to change, but I don't think that highly polarized, like everyone that eats meat is evil. And the other polarity. I don't think that's really helping.
No, definitely not. I'm really trying to open my mind to the idea of eating meat for the sake of, you know, pregnancy and best ever development of the baby. And of course, I'm 1000% against industry farming and all of the disgusting agricultural practices that are happening currently, as well as like farmed fish and stuff like that. I think it's really, really important that if we are going to choose to eat animals, that it's done with heaps of consciousness and compassion. And it doesn't mean that you're any less ethical. I mean, it's such a loaded conversation.
It's such a loaded conversation. It's very tricky. And I think we should have a panel on that at Flow as well. And really discuss it together.
The thing that I keep coming back to is there's no ancient cultures that were vegetarian or vegan. And all of the longevity cultures, you know, the blue zones, they all had very specific ways of eating meat. Mm. So eating the bone broth, eating the whole animal, the organ meats. I think that is important, although it's quite hard to wrap my head around. Like, I know that the liver and the heart are probably the best things for me to eat right now.
Yeah, that's trippy.
But it's such a mental hurdle.
Have you eaten placenta yet?
Well, I haven't eaten someone else's placenta. But have you?
Yeah.
Well, that's makes a bit more sense because it's your wife.
It was so interesting. Like, because even at that time, I wasn't eating meat. I was still just on the more tail end of my strong standpoint on the discussion of meat. I was very vegetarian, but then it was interesting. As soon as that baby Soleil came out and the placenta was right there, I got so primal. And I didn't even know about cultures in the world that serve up the placenta as the meal after birth.
And all of the benefits.
Yeah, I didn't know about any of that at the time. I don't think I did anyway. But just naturally felt compelled and inspired to cut it up and eat it.
Yeah,
mainly we cut it up into little cubes and froze it, like little capsules.
And then take it like a pill.
Yeah, very good for the mom in
replenishing.
But it was such a big placenta, so
it's huge. You're making another organ.
Yeah,
which is just wow. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to be able to think of that when you're feeling so tired and nauseous and whatever in the first trimester. It's cool to think making an organ.
Yeah. If you're listening, like feeling queasy listening to that, apologies at the same time. It's like
toughen up. No, but it's been, I mean, across all, not all ancient cultures, mm-hmm. but many, 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 it's tradition for the mom and oftentimes the family
to eat
the placenta. In Bali, they do it a little bit different. They let the placenta completely drain, so they keep it attached to the baby for as long as lotus birth. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then they burn it. Mm-hmm. And it's really considered to be a life. And it's like a cremation, mm-hmm. as if, you know, they would do for any person that has passed away.
We did something similar with Lani, mm-hmm. because Lani was very late. The placenta was done.
You could just tell.
Wow. You could just tell. So not only did we keep it attached for as long as possible, you could just tell when holding it that it had done every bit of nourishment it could.
Yeah, because she was 42 weeks.
Yeah.
Wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an incredible day, that last day, because if Joe didn't have the baby naturally that day, she was booked in to get induced in hospital. That was just part of being a geriatric mother. That's the classification.
Yeah. If you're above 36, I think it is, geriatric. 36 years old, then you're geriatric.
Isn't that?
It's like the worst awful term ever.
So she was like, I'm having the baby today. And she was, the level of focus was next level.
I love that.
And we got to about the evening and I was like, should we watch a movie? And we often have a movie night on Saturday night. Should we watch a movie? And she's like, we're not watching a movie. I'm having a baby. And we lit the candles and put on some nice music and she just got so, it was a powerful energy of focus.
Mm.
And a few hours later, she had the baby. It's incredible because, like, yeah, she was very over the due date, quote unquote. And she thought, like, she was having a lot of Braxton Hicks every mm-hmm. day and thought, I'm having it today. Holy shit, it's coming on strong. And it just kept getting another day, another day, another day. And then the power of the mind, you know, because it could have just been another day off to hospital. But yeah, that depth of focus and like, no, we're doing it today.
Come on, baby.
It was very cool.
Yeah, I mean, there is so much to be said for the power of the mind. And I've been thinking about that a bit with this eating meat thing because I'm going, okay, I'm waiting for a craving.
Right.
And my body to tell me to eat some meat, mm-hmm. but it hasn't happened. But I'm also thinking maybe my mind and my mental conditioning around this is preventing that craving from coming through. I don't know.
Possibly.
But yeah, in the world of Ayurveda, there's so many cool things that support women in pregnancy and
like what?
Beyond. Well, it's quite hard to find, to be honest. And my theory is that a lot of Ayurveda has been, in I guess the last 100 years, taught by and presented by male doctors. And that part of Ayurveda has kind of been like pushed aside and lost a little bit. So it's quite, when I was in India last year, I was searching everywhere, asking every like Ayurvedic ashram and hospital for books and information and stuff, and no one has anything.
Hmm.
But there's, you know, on a physical level, there's lots of things about optimal fetal positioning, and different movements to do and different types of massage to do to make sure the baby ends up sitting in the right position for a good birth, and also how to turn a baby that might be breech or posterior. There's herbs, of course, to bring on labor. There's also herbs to, how to say it, like the morning after pill, but herbal, basically creating a condition that is not hospitable to conception.
What is it? Do you know?
I can't remember. The They're very like...
It's not Shatavari, is it?
No.
I know that gets a woman really horny, but I don't know what it does the day after.
It's like the anti...
It's like the pre-sex thing. Yeah. What's the post-sex herb?
I don't think it is that one. But yeah, it's really cool. I'm trying to really unearth all of that information for myself, and then hopefully that will become part of what I'm sharing as well later down the track.
I can totally see that. I feel the inspiration.
Yeah. One of my first, like, I guess, goals way back maybe like 10 years ago when I first did my yoga teacher training, I remember making this vision board, and one of the things I put on there was to create a Ayurvedic birthing center. And at the time, I really didn't even know what Ayurveda was. I didn't know what even a birthing center was.
Yeah, right.
It was like so far removed from my life at that point. It was like, you know, 20 or something, and just totally removed from that whole world. None of my friends had kids. It wasn't part of my, wasn't on my radar at all. And now I'm like having that memory recently of that was something I really wanted to do. And I mean, eventually it would be really cool to do something like that.
It's amazing.
I mean, I don't think you could do it in Australia because there's so many laws.
Yeah, I bow to the midwives.
Because I swear, if I wasn't a yoga teacher, I would love to be a midwife.
Yeah, it's such a service. I mean, our last midwife, Marilyn, was such a master. She navigated the birthing journey so skillfully.
Wow.
It was incredible how she coached Joe through it. She had a lot of mental obstacles from the previous birth with Soleil ended up being a little bit hectic, and we needed some intervention. And so she had some obstacles and trauma left over from that. So she was in her head a bit, you know, just doubting herself and stuff like that. And the way this midwife coached Jo through it and really helped her get out of the way, it was like a deep, deep, deep fucking yoga practice.
Totally.
And it was so beautiful to witness and be a part of.
And it's a real spiritual teacher there.
Big time. It's a huge service. And I think they're due much more reverence.
1,000%. I mean, I think in Australia, it's quite hard to even practice private midwifery now. Mm-hmm. Do you know if Joe's midwife was through community?
No, it's private. We had a challenging time with the community program. They kept changing midwife for us, and kept sending us to midwives in like an hour drive away and stuff like that. And it was just becoming really stressful, really, at that, especially in the later months. So
yeah.
With Soleil, we fairly late in the pregnancy decided to go private, and then decided to go private again with the birth of Lani as well. And we're glad we did. It was beautiful, really beautiful. But nothing against the community program, but I think they just have a challenging time with the system.
Well, that's the thing. They're still operating within the medical model.
Right.
And they do not have much wiggle room. And I mean, I think I'm coming off in this podcast as a bit of a conspiracy theory nut, but birth is another area where, yeah, I mean, it's basically been presented as a medical problem.
Well, that's not a conspiracy.
Well, no, I don't think so.
I guess to some people it might seem pretty far out, actually.
Yeah, and I can see, like, having come back and, you know, just having, I had a blood test and the initial ultrasound, and I really want to go, like, as low intervention as possible. And some people would even say having an ultrasound is an intervention, but it's something that I chose to do. And even just having that very brief encounter with the medical model, which I don't usually participate in, I can see how much fear is placed on the woman and how many different ways you're being coerced into this very narrow funnel. And because it is such a vulnerable time, I can see that if you didn't know or want to know more than beyond that, you know, system, it would be really, really hard to resist going down that funnel.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. If you don't have the conversation, like with you, you've got other friends that have done it the way Joe did it and the way other friends have done it. It's part of your conversation. It's a part of your reality. It's what you're interested in.
Exactly.
But yeah, I totally agree. If you didn't have the time to research and read about it and become just educated on it and empowered.
Exactly.
It does seem very scary. And I think there's validity to it to a certain extent, because if shit does go wrong, both the mom and the baby can die, you know? And we experienced that with Soleil, like 20 hours of labor at home, very invested in our plan of having a beautiful home birth. But then shit did go wrong, you know? And the umbilical cord was wrapped around Soleil's neck and no amount of pushing was going to get her out.
There was nowhere for her to go.
Yeah, and if we hadn't have made that choice at that moment to go to the hospital, it could have gotten really bad, really bad. And they could have both died. And I mean, in many parts of the world, it's
that's a reality.
Reality all the time. And it used to be here as well. So I'm grateful for the medical interventions, but it's gone too far. The fear, the birthing process being over medicalized and feared like crazy.
And there are emergency situations like that with Joe and Soleil. And then there's probably 90% of situations where no medical intervention is required.
Exactly.
But very quickly you can get on a slippery slope, and it's called, like,
that's my crazy doorbell.
The cascade of interventions. Where one literally leads to the other. Do you want to pause?
No. No, all good. I think it's, what do they call it? Like promotion thing. Or Mormons or something.
Jehovah's Witness.
Jehovah's Witness, yeah.
That would be a good podcast episode.
Yeah, come on in. Come join in. What were you saying?
But yeah, the cascade of interventions with birth, it's, you know, some people you get induced, and then if you're in a hospital, you're on their time frame. Then you need to have that baby within a certain amount of time, because you're taking up space in your own bed, and that's the way that it goes. And so if you don't progress quickly enough, which is quite difficult to do in a situation in a space like that that isn't ideal for birthing, you know. Ideally, you want to be in a calm, dark, quiet place that you feel comfortable in, not under bright lights with hundreds of strangers coming in and out and people firing you questions and stuff like that.
You're naturally going to contract.
You're
naturally going to freeze.
The body is going, this is not a good place to have birth. So people don't progress. I mean, this can happen. This isn't always, of course. And so then maybe an epidural is required. Also, the contractions that happen after you're induced are like far more intense than a natural contraction.
Yeah.
Because you're getting pumped with these synthetic hormones mm-hmm. that bring it on really strong before you kind of built up to that intensity. And yeah, I mean, without going on and on and on, one thing can lead to another. Then you get the epidural, then that doesn't, you know, then you have a C-section and doctor's happy because he gets to go home at 5 o'clock.
Well, yeah, I was just speaking to a friend yesterday who's also pregnant. I won't say her name just to respect her privacy. She revealed a statistic that's it's a public stat of the crazy amount of C-sections that are done at 4:45.
Mm-hmm.
In particular in Perth.
Yes.
Perth,
I've read that.
Apparently has a very, very high C-section rate.
The highest in the Southern Hemisphere.
Is that right?
Per capita. Yeah. And that's for a few different reasons. But I think the main reason is that it's so normalized.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody you know has had a cesarean, I mean, I guess it's the same with me. If, you know, everybody I know has had a home birth or a
becomes normalized,
intervention-free yeah. birth, yeah, then that becomes part of your reality and like frame of what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't know anyone and everyone that you know has had a cesarean, then it kind of feels like a safe option.
Yeah. And no judgment really. I've got close friends, people I love dearly that consciously choose the C-section route. Like it's a conscious decision. And I don't quite understand that perspective, but I can't quite find the word. Like there's no judgment yet. I can see where they're coming from.
Yeah.
I can see where they're coming from.
No, it's definitely not a judgment thing, but my hope is that, well, we know many of the reasons why it's better for the baby and the mother to have a vaginal birth.
Yeah.
That's widely known. And if you're not sure about that and you're interested, maybe I'll send you a link to some interesting
put it down
research.
Below. Yeah.
But
the bonding, the incredible peak of, it's a peak experience.
Totally. And my hope is that women can have that experience, potentially a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and part of being a human, one of the most beautiful things about being a human. And not that this is the reason, but there's like there's another cool thing of this. DMT is released only at a couple of times, usually at birth and death, but it's also released simultaneously for the baby and the mother during birth. And yeah, that ecstasy of bonding that can happen is something that I would hope everyone can experience.
Yeah. But a lot of people don't even know that.
Mm.
They don't know that.
Well,
it's not mainstream
it's not
information. No, it's not. And yeah, I hope for that conversation to become more available too, because the bonding it creates between the family.
Yeah.
That just can't be compared to. It can't be compared to. And again, if that intervention is required, of course you got to do what you got to do. But when I witnessed what happened with birthing Lani and the connection, and it was a mystical experience. Mm. And then them cuddling up in bed, they didn't leave the bedroom for weeks. For 2 weeks.
Beautiful.
I think that's what they do in a lot of the East. You know, the mom and baby don't leave the house for weeks if possible. You
the
know?
40 days postpartum is another big thing that people don't maybe know about or want to know about or honor as much in our culture. It's very much that attitude of having to get up and get back to normal and also like have everyone over to see the baby and stuff like that. Whereas in Bali, for example, and in many different cultures, in Bali, they do, I think it's for the first 40 days, the parents don't leave the home, as well as the baby, of course. But the baby doesn't actually leave the home for 90 days.
Is that right?
So that original, you know, phase of becoming in the body and grounding, and that transition from being, you know, a soul out there into a grounded being, earth side, is really understood to be like fundamental in the way that we relate to the world. And there's probably some pretty cool research around all of the different fears and insecurities and issues that we have culturally around belonging and even finances and those baseline things like shame that come from, yeah, insecurity that probably have a lot to do with that formative time. Yeah.
A friend, I just want to keep sharing these pregnancy stories. A friend of Joe's.
Birth stories podcast.
Yeah. I'm taking over Joe's podcast, which she hasn't released yet. A friend of Joe's had her baby solo in the jungle, in the Amazonian jungle, on ayahuasca. So she knew she was going in, labor had begun. Took a full dose of ayahuasca, went out into the jungle solo and had that baby.
I mean, obviously this is someone that's super familiar with the medicine and has that relationship. Yeah, I mean,
we're not suggesting that. Without a doubt, I'd be scared shitless if Joe made that decision to have a baby. But that's next level.
Yeah, I recently listened to a podcast about a woman that had first baby, free birth at home, actually in Topanga in California, in her treehouse, you know, very off the grid sort of thing. Second baby, same thing. That baby was huge and, you know, it was quite an intense thing, but she did it. Third pregnancy, she was then in Costa Rica and basically was giving birth, and first one came out and then the second one started to come out and it was surprise twins.
Wow.
Because she, you know, had zero scans, zero intervention. Wow. Totally wild. Can you imagine that? Like, okay, yay, the baby's here. And then she was thinking, wow, this placenta is really heavy and hard to birth. Shit. And then all of a sudden she like reaches down and feels, oh, there's another baby coming. So that was one reason why I wanted to have a scan, because my brother and sister are twins and I wanted to know if there was going to be two.
So did we. Joe's got a lot of twins in her lineage and we wanted to know as well.
It changes everything. My mom still says like, oh, that was the best, having two, it was amazing, da, da, da. But I'm like, oh God, I was eight and I remember like how huge she was and, you know, just breastfeeding like two at a time. It's just whoa. Full respect to the mom.
What do you think of the potential of orgasming while birthing a baby?
I actually listened to a podcast with the woman that, you know, kind of started this orgasmic birth thing. And even she kind of says, it wasn't orgasmic. I wasn't having an orgasm. But her whole message was reframing pain into sensation.
Yeah.
So, which I'm totally on board with, you know. And I think even it's becoming maybe mainstream, people not calling them contractions anymore, but calling them like surges, stuff like that.
Yeah, you're right.
Because when you think about it as well, I mean, the contraction is like, yeah, that is what's happening to
the
uterus.
But there's also an expansion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's simultaneous. And if you yourself are thinking, okay, contract.
Here comes another expansion.
But surge is like you're riding the waves, like the surge. So even the orgasmic birth lady didn't really necessarily sell it as an orgasm. And the reason that documentary was ended up being called Orgasmic Birth was really for like a marketing thing.
Right.
And they talked about that.
And it looked orgasmic.
It looked like, orgasmic, yeah. Because she was fully surrendered and riding the waves.
Riding the waves. And we learn that in yoga as well, of like breathing through the sensation and using your breath and using sound. And you can
sound
do that in the birth,
you
know, rather than what would be the more conditioned image of birthing, like gritting the jaw, which I think it seems there's a time for that, to really just give it your all, give it that one final push. But it seems, what she was doing was relaxing through the contraction.
Intensity.
Something's contracting.
Well, even like if you've had a experience with Kundalini energy, that can feel...
Can feel pain. It's intense.
On the border of like pleasure and pain,
yes.
Right? And that intensity can be kind of scary because you feel like you might die.
Yeah.
And I kind of imagine this was what labor could feel like as well. Like there is a death. There's a death of your former life and the former you. And people say this kind of line that you are not only birthing your baby, but you're rebirthing yourself.
Yeah. It's a huge rite of passage.
Totally.
Yeah.
This could turn into a very long podcast.
We're nearly at an hour and a half.
Talking about birth is one of my favorite topics.
But I think it's inspiring for women, just kind of observing the conversation from multiple vantage points. Like whether you're coming from that place of the doctor knows everything, I don't know shit, booked in for that C-section. I hope one from that vantage point can at least hear these other possibilities. I hope that it's inspiring and refreshing, not you got to fucking do it this way.
No.
I really hope it's just
again,
like...
Again, that dogmatic thing.
Exactly.
Is nowhere to be near
and
the conversation
for men,
of birth.
I hope it's inspiring for men. Mm-hmm. Like it's still very new for us dads to be present.
To be in the
room. In the room.
Yeah.
That's still very new.
Totally.
So, to feel supported and at ease and of service in that moment, because it's such a special moment.
Holding space.
And for the mamas, you know, to further allow for this unfoldment of women being empowered. This is a huge part of women
birthing
being empowered.
In power. Yeah. And I think the big message, if there is one, is that it's about choice and being informed, being educated, feeling empowered to make the choice that you want to make for you and your baby, and that there's no right or wrong. Every birth is different. And, you know, I've had friends as well that have had, medicalized births, and without the tools of yoga and breath and a certain level of understanding about that stuff, if there is no framework in that way and they are feeling very scared and anxious and fearful about birth, then maybe, you know, having a medically supported birth is the best option for them.
Sure. Yeah, good call.
And I think choice is the big thing, and just to kind of feel empowered to choose for yourself. Mm-hmm. But there's some beautiful education, and I really think everyone should get into it.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful birthing center that I'm connected with in Bali that their motto is "A peaceful birth is a peaceful earth." Mm. And just kind of going off that line, it is the way that we are, we're birthing the next generation onto this planet. And so my hope is that we can do it in the most optimal, fear-free way. And that, I think, will have a massive ripple effect on our trajectory humanity.
Yeah, that's a good place to wrap it up, Mandy.
Thanks for having me, Stu.
Yeah. See you soon.
Yeah.
And see you all at
Flow Festival.
January 10th, 2020.
We can't wait to see you there.
Yeah. Much love.
Ciao.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed that, please take a moment to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Check out the YouTube version if you feel like it. Share the love on your social media. All that support really is deeply appreciated. If you feel like further supporting, hop onto stuartwatkins.org/podcast, and there are donate buttons there if you feel inspired to support in that way. To all of you that have been donating and supporting, I bow to you with so much gratitude. Thank you so much. It's been an awesome year of creating these podcast episodes for you. And it's a deep practice for me. I enjoy it so much. But thank you for helping to keep it going. It really requires the support of the community to help keep it going. So thank you so much. I am endlessly grateful. So I'll see you hopefully at the workshop at Spunda Yoga School, December 14th, 2 till 5, and or at Flow Festival, January 10th till 12th weekend. I'll leave all the links below. Be sure to check out Amanda Noga and her social media and her website and support her awesome work as well. That's it for now. Much love, and I hope to see you around Perth, Fremantle, up in the hills and Serpentine over the summer. Much love.